Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The advice and opinions expressed by the host of Autism Live and her guests are meant solely as suggestion and should not be in any way construed as child-specific advice. Any choices you make in determining your child's treatment are completely at your own discretion.
Good morning and welcome to Autism Live in April. We're so excited to be here and oh my goodness, we've got a lot of serious stuff to talk about today, but we're going to get through it. Everybody's going to take a breath and we're going to get through it. And we've got an amazing, amazing expert who's going to be joining us in just a few minutes. Jennifer Barreto is going to be with us and she's the clinical director of severe challenging behavior at the Center for Autism and Related Disorders, a true expert in this field and an amazing resource to talk about some of the tougher stuff. So I'm so excited that she's going to be joining us in just a few minutes because she's, you know, if you got to talk about the stuff, tough stuff, let's talk about it with somebody who is a really centered, kind, empathetic person. So that's Jennifer Barreto. So she's going to join. And a mom, and a wonderful, wonderful mom as well. So we are live right now, and we're thrilled to be here with you guys. I want to let you know that you can be writing in your questions right now on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. That's all available to you. Our wonderful Chris Desmond is showing it to you on the screen right now because he's great like that. Also want to remind you that the lion's share of you will be listening in podcasts later on, and that's wonderful. We love having you listen in podcasts. A couple of things. If you have questions, you can always feel free to write in. You can write in directly to me if you'd like to. You can write to Shannon at autism-live.com. I love getting your emails. I love getting your questions. And often if you write in a question and it's for one of our experts that you saw on the show, just do me a favor and tell me, you know, you could say, oh, the lady who was talking about self-injurious behavior. Because if you just say, I saw your show today and it was so-and-so, and I don't know which day it was, then I have to become Sherlock Holmes, and I'm not good at that. And I want to answer your question, and I want to get it to the right person. So help me out. Give me some descriptors. Even if you can't remember the person's name, it will help me to know who to go back to the question with. You can even just say the topic, and then I will pretty much be able to figure it out. So we also want to say to you that those of you who listen to us in podcasts, it is a free download wherever you get your podcasts. It will come with ads because that's how it works, right? There was a cost for doing the show. We want it to be free to you. So there's advertisements on the podcast and hopefully you will embrace that. If you are someone who's like, I'd really like to have it without the advertisements and I'd be willing to pay a little bit per month, we do have that option for you as well. You can go to glow.fm/autismlive and for $5 a month, it's actually cheaper if you do it not on a monthly basis. If you do it on the yearly basis, it's actually cheaper for you. But even at $5, that's a low cost if you're wanting to get that without the ads. Here's the super fun part is that you get not only Autism Live and everything we do on Autism Live, but you also get Ask Dr. Doreen and everything we do on Ask Dr. Doreen. And that's all for that one low cost. And you get it ad free and they will put it automatically in your inbox, wherever you tell it to go, and then you'll have it with no ads so that when you're in the car, you've got that. But if you are okay with the ads, enjoy the ads. It's all good for us. We want to get the information to you. You know, if you watch or listen to us, that Our whole thing here, our whole mission, our whole driving force is to provide information and inspiration to that larger autism community that starts with individuals on the spectrum, of course, but also includes the people who love them. Because we feel together, we can do all kinds of things, right? Si se puede. And many of us, myself included, want to be good allies. I like to remind all of us that being a good ally doesn't mean that we're perfect. And I know I'm not perfect, but I want to be a good ally and I want to be better on a regular basis. And that I hope that I'm not often all the time wrong, but I'm going to be occasionally. But then I can change, right? Change is a thing that I can choose to do. So anyway, having said all that, we need to get into some of what we're talking about today. And I don't know why I decided to have this be our jargon of the day, because I knew we were going to be talking about it. That's why. But this is a tough, tough subject. Just going to remind you, keep breathing all through today. Just keep breathing and remember that there's hope and there's help. Okay. So let's get into our jargon of the day, which is SIB. As you know, when we do jargon of the day, we give you an actual definition. Sometimes I will poke fun at it because of the jargon in it. There will be no poking of fun today, but there will be clarifications. Then we give you sometimes another definition that is a little less jargon intensive, hopefully, or addresses another part of it. And then I will try to give you examples and help you to understand why it's important you know this term and can use this term appropriately, especially if you're seeking help. So today's jargon term, it's right up there on the screen, SIB. So let's take a look at our actual definition, which will explain to us that SIB stands for self-injurious behavior. And today's definition is coming to us right from the National Institute for Health. So it's NIH.gov. And this is SIB across all people. This is not particular to autism, especially this definition. Self-injurious behavior is defined as the commission of deliberate injury to one's own body done without the aid of another person and is severe enough to cause tissue damage or scarring. I don't know about you, but that's like a punch to the gut, right? There are some parts of this definition that I'm not in love with, because I think when we're talking about individuals on the spectrum, the word deliberate is hard, right? Because how can you determine whether somebody cognitively understood that what they were doing was going to cause them permanent damage? And the requirement for this definition is that it's causing damage that, you know, and scarring that is permanent. And I think back to my son being 3, he was not cognizant of that when he would hurt himself. He used to hit his head on the kitchen floor. He wasn't cognizant of that. Was it a deliberate act? Yes, but he was not. I guess I take issue with he wasn't aware of what the consequences are. And this doesn't quite address that for me. But it's a horrible, horrible thing, and it's scary, and this addresses part of that. Let's go on to our working definition, which is actually from Kennedy Krieger, which is an organization, a facility that is, I think, largely accepted as being one of, if not the best place to deal with this kind of behavior. They had a bigger definition that I didn't want to give because it was close to the other one, but slightly tweaked, maybe a little bit better. But this was the part of this definition that I felt was most important to continue with, which was common forms of SIB include, but are not limited to, head hitting, head banging, and self-biting. Self-injurious behavior can result in minor injuries such as scratches and bruises, or more severe injuries such as blindness, broken bones, or even death. Oh, everybody take a breath, right? Because there is a spectrum here in this definition that I need for everybody to acknowledge. Sometimes, and we're going to talk about this with Jennifer Barreto, sometimes our kiddos are doing something, and to say that it's self-injurious behavior, I can tell you, when my son was hitting his head on the kitchen floor, I would never have classified it as self-injurious behavior. Even now, after all these years, to look at this and go, oh, they said headbanging is self-injurious behavior. And my gut doesn't want to term it that, because as a parent, we don't want that for our kids. But running away from it isn't the thing that helps either, right? And I want you to also see that the scratching and the bruising also counts as self-injurious behavior. It doesn't have to be something that results in an emergency room visit to qualify as self-injurious behavior. You know, the one example that always I just go, oh, is the little girl who was peeling her hands on a regular basis. It started out as just a thing like maybe there was some skin and she peeled and peeled and peeled until her hands were raw. Her hands were raw. And I mean, that's self-injurious behavior. This is the serious stuff. I want you just to take a minute and again, breathe and think about, is there anything going on in your life? And it can be with the person that you love the most on the spectrum, but it could be anything. Is there any instance of self-injurious behavior going on in your life, whether it's you or someone you love? Because if it is, I want to welcome you to this hour where we're going to talk about this stuff and talk about getting help and support and letting go of this reality to move to a better one. Because that's really what it's all about. And I plan on sharing some of the things that I felt as a parent that were not helping me to get to that help. Right? That were causing me to maybe hold back from admitting what was going on. And the first step is acknowledging that it's going on. You don't have to put the label on it if you don't want to. I'm not going to force you to do that, right? But I hope that you will see the seriousness of this. And I really hope that in this hour, you feel the hope that there are answers, that there is hope, that there are people you can lean into and services and support that you can lean into to get this to a better day. That's really what it's all about. And a big part of that is going to be talking with Jennifer Barreto. She is our expert for the day. So we're going to take a short break, and then I promise you, you're just going to love this young woman and what she has to say, because she has a huge, huge heart for individuals on the spectrum. So don't go away. Stick with us. Si se puede, right? We're going to get through this together. We'll be right back after these messages. Thanks for joining us during Autism Awareness Acceptance Action, all the other A's this month on the Autism Network. Here on Autism Live, we've got a great week for you. On Monday, Lisa Ackerman, founder of TACA, the Autism Community in Action, is going to be with us, and she is always amazing. Then on Tuesday, Ask Dr. Doreen. Dr. Doreen Grampiche will be here, and her very special topic for that day will be aggression. If you're having anything going on in your home where you're concerned about aggression, make sure you tune in for that show. Then on Wednesday, another wonderful autism expert, Marcy Bibro, is going to be here with us. We can't wait to be joined by her. On Thursday in our lineup, Jennifer Yakos, who has been on our shows for many years, but we haven't seen her in a while, she is going to be here talking about some of the new exciting things going on at CARD. We cannot wait to have that hour. Then on Friday, for the very first time, those of you who love the show Love on the Spectrum on Netflix, the U.S. version, we are welcoming Abby Romero along with her mom, Christine. We know that a lot of you are fans of both of them. They're going to be joining us on Friday for the very first time. So excited about that. We hope that you'll tune in all week long. If you miss any of the shows, you can catch them easily in podcasts. check out all of the schedule for the entire month by visiting any of our social media channels. We hope to see you. Welcome back. As I promised you before the break, we've got an amazing guest joining us right now. Jennifer Barreto is joining us. She is a wonderful, wonderful clinician. She's the clinical director of severe challenging behavior at the Center for Autism and Related Disorders, CARD. She has been working in this field for over 14 years. As I said, she's an amazing clinician with such empathy and heart for individuals who are on the spectrum. When you think about what kind of person, I'm going to cry. When you think about what kind of person can specialize in things like severe challenging behavior and things like self-injurious behavior, what we were just talking about, the kind of person who says, yes, I want to devote my time and energy to helping those kinds of people, you know that you're talking about somebody with a tremendous heart and patience and empathy that can't be measured. And that certainly describes Jennifer Barreto. I also want to mention that so many of these experts that we're featuring on the show, I know you guys look at them and go, oh my gosh, they look so young, and they are so young. And that she is also a young mom with her own kids and a brilliant, brilliant mom. So wonderful to invite her to be on the show during April and to talk about this really serious subject that we hope that we can shed some light on, severe challenging behavior, of course, including, I'm already weeping, stop it, including self-injurious behavior, but all the other things that we were talking about as well and more. So let's welcome Jennifer Barreto. There you are. It's so good to see you. What a shining light you are. So Jennifer, it's so wonderful to have someone who is so bright and humane to talk about this kind of a subject, because this is the tough stuff, right?
It is.
Why is this? Why? I didn't tell you I was going to throw this at you, but why? It just occurred to me. Why is this your particular area of interest? Why does this call to you?
Actually, when we recently changed some of our roles at CARD, our founder and CEO, Doreen, asked us to choose what we felt like we wanted to do and wanted to sort of be an expert in when we made the clinical director role. And I chose severe challenging behavior. It's just something that I have always been really passionate about, seeing and helping families and our clinicians just see a big difference in the challenging behaviors that some of our kids and adults are engaging in. Is just so rewarding when we see it can really change a person's life,
yeah,
and a family's life when, you know, you have something like severe aggression that's happening on a frequent basis. And then even just a reduction to, you know, that can open up so many more opportunities. You know, sometimes schools have a hard time managing those types of behaviors. So, you know, we do things like work with the schools in some cases. We always work with the families, which I'm sure we'll get into in a little bit, but just opportunities can open up and maybe families feel like they can now take their child to a restaurant where they weren't able to do that previously. And they feel so much more optimistic about their child's future.
That's
I hope
amazing.
I answered your question. I went off on a tangent.
But. No, you answered my question beautifully. And I could listen to you talk about it all day long because I don't think you understand. I mean, I'm like already weeping on the show. I don't think you understand how much that means to people, parents who have kids who are engaging in severe challenging behavior because we are going to get into it because sometimes we're made to feel like pariahs. And the fact that you chose it, and it's because you have this confidence that we can get to a better place, gives us hope, Jennifer. So just that gives us hope and is amazing. We could be done, but let's talk about more. Let's start off by talking about what, for you, what do you consider severe challenging behavior? Because there might be some people watching this that have already decided that they're living with a behavior that they don't understand would be considered severe, challenging behavior and might be something that could be worked on. So what's the basket look like that includes severe, challenging behavior?
Sure. Maybe I'll just define it and then I will give some examples. So I consider it, and we consider it at CARD, any behavior that could pose harm to the individual themselves or people around them, or in some cases their environment. And I also put any behaviors that could compromise their dignity under that umbrella as well. And sometimes also harm that could be caused to the environment.
Okay. So that's pretty all-encompassing. And I love that you've added something that could harm their dignity. Can you give, for people who are like, wow, I never really thought about that way, can you give an example of what that might look like?
Absolutely. So maybe disrobing, inappropriate sexual behavior, inappropriate urinating or defecating in different places outside of the bathroom or toilet. So those are all behaviors that we, you know, it's a concern if it happens in public or outside the home or even in certain places in the home. It can be stressful and problematic for families. And so those are sort of the things that are within that compromise of dignity. And then some of the other challenging behaviors that I see on a frequent basis and help with are elopement or running away, self-injurious behavior, aggression, destruction of property, which can be, you know, it can range from anything to through like electronics or maybe home furnishings, such as windows or anything like that. Which is definitely dangerous and can be expensive to repair.
It's a lot. And it gives us all a little bit of pause. And I want to remind all of us that we need to keep breathing through this conversation. I've been talking about this show for a week that you were going to come on and talk about this. And this is a very important conversation for people to hear. But if you feel yourselves getting emotional, what advice do we have for people, Jennifer, that have come here and we're going to talk about this, but it might be triggering, right?
It's very difficult, for a lot of families to seek help because it can be, you know, embarrassing or cause fear. Like, how can anybody help me when I'm in this position?
Yeah.
And so part of my role at CARD is I do two different things. I perform consultations with some of the patients that we already have here that maybe we're seeing an increase in frequency of behavior, like it's just happening more often, or maybe the severity, it's just gotten more severe and more difficult to deal with. So I see patients that we already have here. And then I also look at families that are coming in for an intake, and we're looking at everything and whether or not we can actually help them. We try and do everything we can to help as many patients as possible. But I sort of look at both of those things. And I think it's difficult for a lot of families to come to the intake and to share and divulge all that information with us.
Yeah. I want to talk about that for a second. And then I want to come back to something you just said. So help me to remember. But you mentioned the word fear, and there can be so much fear just to talk about it from parents. I know that I've talked about before on the show, when my son was little, and believe me, I understand the difference between when somebody is little and he would hit me, and he would hit me in the face and in the head, and it was really hard for me. And I understand that he was 3, 4, and 5 when he was doing that. And by the time he was 5, we had almost eradicated it. And by the time he was 6, it never happened again. And I talk to families on a regular basis where it's their 17-year-old kid who's popping them in the head. And I remember what it felt like when he was 3. I want to make room for the fact that it's much more as the children get older. But there was fear. There was real fear, and on so many different levels, and I've talked to so many different parents about this, that it's hard to admit it sometimes because we're afraid that people will think our children are monsters and judge them for it. Some of us are afraid that if we admit it, that somebody will say your child should not be at home with you. You're not coping with it right. Your child should be placed outside of the home. And that feels like failure and death. And that we're just afraid, period. Afraid that something is going to happen and our child's going to hurt themselves or that we're going to get hurt. I know parents right now that are afraid that something's going to happen and their child will harm them and they won't be able to call for help. How do you help parents in an intake? How do you deal with that, Jennifer? How do you help to get over and around and through that to get them to even admit that something's going on?
The first thing we do is we just try to make parents feel comfortable during the intake and know that they're in a safe place. And that the only way we can help is if we know all of the details.
Yeah.
We have an internal assessment that we ask parents to sort of just share the information with us. And we go through, you know, what are they experiencing at home in the community? We try to understand where the behaviors are happening and also how often. And we try to ask questions about function of the behavior. So when we talk about function, we try to figure out why the behaviors are happening. So we try to get all that information before we begin services so that we can create an individualized treatment plan for their child when they begin services with us.
I hope people are seeing how calm you are about it and that it's a thing that you want to talk about it and find out what the function is. I want everybody to recognize that because there's no part of you that's judging the parent. There's no part of you that's judging the kiddo who is engaging in this behavior. That there is this very logical, pragmatic thing amongst you BCBAs where you go, well, it's happening for a reason. Let's figure out what the reason is and let's change the circumstances around the reason. And that is amazing. There's so much hope in that. So let's take that one step further. So a parent comes to you and they're in the intake and they find because you're so welcoming and because you are so centered and encouraging them to tell you everything so that you can help, they decide to tell you about this behavior and you start trying to figure out what the function of the behavior is. Is it appropriate to say, can we come up with an example of like something that's happening? It could be obviously you won't tell us who, we don't want to disclose anybody's personal, but maybe a story that can give us hope for a good outcome of what happened as a result.
Sure. Like a success story that I've with an existing patient. I have a few of those. I've done many consultations over the years. I've had different roles at CARD and a lot of them in the last 5 to 6 years have involved helping with cases with severe challenging behavior. Mm-hmm. So I've definitely seen a few through to a really positive place. But I have a couple examples. We had one patient who had a lot of severe aggression. His parents were separated and he was living with one of the parents. And that parent was having a really difficult time managing the behavior. He was larger and bigger than that parent. And he ended up doing a temporary inpatient stay. And after about 6 months there, he transitioned back into his home setting. There were some environmental changes that were involved, but then he ended up coming back to services with us and the challenging behavior completely reduced.
Okay.
Not seeing it anymore, which is fantastic. That case, you know, it was difficult for us to help because the behavior was happening with the parents only and not so much with us in the clinic, which is maybe something we can talk about.
Yeah.
But he was able to come back to services, and there are cases where we may recommend a more intense or severe treatment facility.
I wanted you to remind me to get back to, because you said before during the intake, we try to evaluate if we are able mm-hmm. to help this family. Mm-hmm. And so I love that you're being so honest with our viewers about the fact that sometimes the setting for ABA and the way that insurance pays for ABA, I want to be clear about mm-hmm. that because I remember a time when CARD was able to help in some of those more severe cases that now, you know, we recommend inpatient hospitalizations because insurance won't pay to have multiple people on the team. And sometimes that's what it requires. If I'm saying anything that's wrong, correct me. But it used to be that sometimes they would ask on a case if it was one of our, what I call our gentle giants, who are going through a period of time, because, you know, these are big young men who are strong. There were used to be times where CARD would say, well, if we have two or even three behavior technicians, we can target this behavior. Insurance really doesn't pay for that anymore. I see across the board. So there are times when, and insurance has said, we see that your quicker success when this person is out of the home, out of the, you know, and in an inpatient. Mm-hmm. So correct me if I say anything that's off the mark. Am I okay?
Yeah.
So
I think it depends on the insurance company in large part, of course, but if yes. they're in a more severe treatment facility, they're more than likely going to pause services with us so they can get the help at that facility. And then the hope would be that they transition back to one-to-one services with CARD because we're a lesser, less intense yeah. service provider.
In fact, I certainly have seen several times where there was a recommendation to go do an inpatient stay, and the condition upon coming home was that they had a reputable ABA service on board ready to restart services to uphold what had happened at the inpatient. But so tell people what kinds of things may, you know, result in somebody saying, you know, this is going to require an immersive environment in which we can control more of the variables, that inpatient stay?
It's usually a last resort. I mean, in some cases, we know, you know, from the intake that we aren't able to help. It often depends on the patient's size and whether or not they have the right environment at home, you know, to be able to, maybe if their parents are smaller than they are or they're elderly, they may not be able to manage some of those behaviors. Yeah. So in those cases, maybe we would recommend an inpatient stay. But I think, you know, we try and do everything we can at the end, see if we can help. In some cases, though, we will recommend starting with just maybe a parent training model so that we can help the family. A lot of times, more severe treatment facilities like inpatients, it depends, of course, but some of the more severe treatment behavior facilities have wait lists.
Yes.
Not necessarily an inpatient stay at a hospital, but whether it's temporary residential care or long-term residential care, they often have wait lists. So we can, whether or not we're providing direct services with the behavior technicians, the BCBS can always work with the families. And sometimes from an intake, we'll just do that model if we feel like the parents just need our help right now.
Yeah.
So that's an option. And we do everything we can to try to figure out if we can help.
Yeah.
And we always provide referrals and resources if we unfortunately may not be able to.
So talk for just a second about some of the things that you might be teaching a parent in a parent training model to help intervene with these kinds of behaviors.
Absolutely. We want to be able to empower parents or caregivers so that they feel like they can manage the challenging behavior when we're not there. And that's the goal.
Yeah.
So, you know, of course, having the support of a BCBA and ABA services is ideal. But what we do is I was talking about function. We often try to understand function, and function can change based on the environment. So we try to understand how often it's happening, where it's happening, and why it's happening, because it can certainly change depending on the situation. And so we will, in some cases, create an individualized plan just for the home setting, just that parents can implement. And it may not be as detailed as an ABA intervention would be at the clinic setting, but it's something that parents can implement realistically in the home. And sometimes that's purchasing blocking equipment. Sometimes that's just changing some of the antecedents or some of the things that they can do prior to behaviors happening. But we always want to be able to give them the tools so that they can do it themselves and feel comfortable implementing what we're implementing You know, because if we do everything at the clinic and we reduce the behaviors at the clinic, that's really great. But we also want to make sure that the behaviors are being, you know, that they're reducing in other environments too. So we try to, you know, we aim for consistency across environments, which is why we will collaborate with schools as well, like I mentioned, or sometimes other community professionals if we're able to. Anywhere that, you know, the patients go, we can try and collaborate with and just make sure that we have that consistency and that support for that person, no matter where they go.
I want to talk about our case because I can talk freely about it. But again, I want to say that my son was young and I was infinitely bigger than him. But there was a period of time in which he was hitting me. And I was being asked to make sure that I blocked it, that him getting the opportunity to hit me, and I can think of one time that he hit me in the face and I could not stop myself from reacting because I'm a human being, right? And that whatever it was about that for him, he was too young and didn't have enough life experience to understand that I was actually hurt. And the expression that I use is that it was good theater for him, that I was crying, I was upset, and it fed something that was not what we want to feed for him wanting to do it again, because he didn't understand that he was hurting me. Now, so I was being taught to, you know, make sure that we were doing things beforehand, as you were saying, so that he wouldn't have the need to hit me, but that if he reached up to hit me, to block it. And I want to say that as a parent, that feels like a very weird thing, that we're learning how to block being hit from our children. So I had to get over that hump. And then I had to actually learn the techniques and I had to figure out how to put my feelings aside while it was happening so that I could make sure that I carried out the intervention. It was stinking hard and I didn't always get it right. And then I would berate myself because I wasn't getting it right. But I want you to talk a little bit about that, Jennifer, and how you help families to learn this important task of blocking, because I don't think it occurs to us, especially when our kids are older, it occurs to us to, like, you know, to block it. But I, for our younger kids, I hear from other parents all the time, yeah, it didn't occur to me. It's just a weird thing. But how do you teach that?
We have an internal training that we use. It's a safety management training. And we focus a lot on prevention, but there are some times when you can't prevent challenging behaviors from happening and they happen anyway. And it's mostly, blocking is meant to just be for safety, to try to protect yourself. Or sometimes, you know, when we're dealing with aggression, you want to protect the person that's being targeted, but you also want to, in some cases, like with self-injurious behavior, protect the person that's engaging in that behavior from any harm that they could potentially pose to themselves. So you can block self-injurious behavior as well. In a lot of cases, it's, you know, difficult to block that because you can't always, especially if the behavior happens kind of frequently, to predict how often it's going to happen. But blocking is, and we, you know, we do it for many different types of things. Sometimes we'll try to block someone from disrobing, just to protect their dignity. But we mainly do it for safety and to prevent harm, or any injury for the patient or anybody working with them or their families.
Yeah.
I'm sure, you know, as a parent, it does feel awkward. It's, you know, I'm sure it doesn't feel, it's probably not something that comes naturally.
Yeah.
But we do train a lot of our families. And like you said, Shannon, you know, families who have older children or adult children that, you know, are living with them, that they feel, sometimes I've heard, you know, families say, I feel scared, that, you know, I'm not going to be able to handle this, or I'm not going to be able to handle it at some point. And so we want to be able to help those families and empower them to be able to implement all types of strategies to hopefully prevent us to get to that point where we have to block, but just knowing how to block if the time comes so that we can keep everybody safe.
I also,
your question.
Yeah, no, you totally did. And I also feel prompted to say too, that there is a terrible, you know, you're upside down when, that I experienced and that I have heard from other parents that they're experiencing, which is that, getting hit becomes your new normal. And then there comes a time when we already talked about the fact you're afraid to let other people know that it's happening, but there comes this little insidious justification that you find yourself saying, I probably deserved it. And it's because, and fill in the blank. And for me, it was, well, it's my fault that he hit me. I probably had it coming because I didn't block right, or I didn't do the antecedent right, or whatever. But I want to say to parents everywhere listening, if you're in that mindset, that is upside down. That is upside down thinking. It is not your fault. It is not your child's fault. Take the fault word and the guilt word and put it in the circular trash bin and call the person that is helping you with your child. I hope you have a good ABA provider. And I'm so grateful that our card families have you, Jennifer, that they can reach out and say, okay, I'd like to be on the path to better days. How can we get there? I want to keep talking about something difficult, but I want another success story before we get there. Have you got another success story to help us get through it?
I do. There was a patient that we had. He was definitely a larger young man, and he was engaging in challenging behavior in school, at home, and at the clinic with us. And it was getting to the point where we were having difficulty managing it. So what we did was we paused services for a short time, and we worked with the parents during that time. The BCBA never stopped working with the parents. And then we looked into a 2-to-1 model. So that means we have 2 BTs working with the one patient.
Yeah.
He needed more support in the clinic environment. And so we moved to that model while, of course, keeping the parents involved every step of the way. We usually do that when we feel like the 1-to-1 model with the BT and ABA is not effective any longer. So we looked into doing that, and some insurances cover it and some don't.
Yeah.
It just totally depends on the plans and the contracts maybe that are drawn up with each facility. But in this case, we did a 2-to-1 model with him, and then we were able to fade that back. So we got the behaviors to reduce. And then he worked 1-to-1, and now he's still with us, and he's getting 1-to-1 now. And
and are things going better at home?
Yes, in every environment. So the BCBA also did her due diligence to collaborate with the school.
Wonderful.
And things are going really smoothly. I just saw him a couple weeks ago.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, I love hearing that. It's inspiring. And that BCBA did such a wonderful job and has worked so hard to just support that family in their time of need and support in the school environment. She has a great relationship with the school, and it's just really heartwarming to be able to see just the success that comes from, you know, everybody working together and supporting.
I really want to say too, that I want to say kudos to whoever that insurance company was, because I know a lot of them won't do that now. I understand the rationale behind it. I do understand that in some circumstances, some of our kids do need to go someplace else for a while. I don't want parents to be afraid of that. That can sometimes feel like it's the worst thing that could happen, but I have seen that time and time and time again. When you can get in, when you don't have to wait 2 years on the waiting list, I have seen that change the whole dynamic, that while the child is in there getting that intensive environment, the parents are still learning about what to do, and then there is this, you know, environment that they come back to and they flourish in, which is really amazing. But I want to talk about, because our jargon today was self-injurious behavior, and I promised that we would talk about self-injurious behavior, because this is often the hardest thing under the sun. I have heard parents say, I wish they would hit me and not hit themselves. Or, you know, the fear that the mom who's got the daughter who constantly peels the skin on her hands to the point where they are just bloody, and there's like permanent damage. it's a really difficult area to talk about. It's a difficult area to treat because sometimes finding the function can be hard. Bring us your expertise on this subject because we need it.
Absolutely. I think what you touched on was really important, Shannon, that SIB, well, we call it SIB for short, self-injurious behavior, they can take many different forms, you know, a body part to a body part to a wall or a floor or a surface, an object to a body part, or something like, you know, scratching themselves, using an object to cut themselves. Any way that an individual could cause harm to themselves using any of the forms that I described, any way that they can inflict harm on themselves. And those are just some of the different ways that self-injurious behavior can take shape. And so, of course, one of the things that we do while we're in ABA is we look at function. We try to come up with an individualized treatment plan to address the behavior, work with the family, work with the school, wherever that patient goes, we try to go and see where we can help. If a family is not getting help, I mean, I would say and advocate for them getting help as soon as they can. Whether it's from a BCBA or seeing their doctor or psychologist or another professional, you know, temporary inpatient stay, a day program, a severe behavior facility, there are people out there that can help. There are resources out there. We have, you know, plenty of resources out there on the internet, and I know I'm sure Autism Live has resources as well. But if you're not getting help, you want to be able to, I would say, put that on your list to try to, you know, reach out to somebody or do some research to figure out where you can get help. Yeah. But you want to be able to do everything you can to keep your child safe at home or wherever they go. If they're going to school, make sure you're talking to the school about how they're keeping them safe. I would say invest in ways to block or pad their environment or remove access to any dangerous objects in the meantime. Just to try to reduce the chance that they could harm themselves.
Yeah. I love hearing you talk about this because I think it is so important that we don't shy away from it. But I also think it's important to say to parents, you are not meant to deal with this alone. As you were just saying, that it's so important to lean into whoever you have or to find those resources. I do feel, and you're a mom, you can speak to this, that our children come out and they do not come with manuals. There are no manuals. And yet we are expected to just figure it out as parents. We're expected to just figure it out. I don't know how we have all these rules about you can't graduate from high school until you're able to add this, do this, and write this essay. But I wish they would require that people understood how to parent, how to be safe with small children, what to do if your child is not what you expected, because no child is. No child comes out and is the child that they expected it to be. But when your child has a disability and when it has severe challenging behaviors, there is no instruction manual that came with the child. But there are instruction manuals. And there are people who can help and support, but you should never, ever have an expectation that you should be doing this by yourself. It just isn't a realistic thing. Even if it's somebody helping you via Zoom, because you live in a remote area, but somebody to help you to strategize and role play and figure it out and know how to put the pads on. Because you could buy padding, and if you don't know how to use the padding appropriately, you're not really going to be helping yourself or your child with the challenging behavior. So I hope that everybody hears that there is hope, and that you are not expected to know this without getting help and support. Any last thoughts that you want to give to families so that they know that, these behaviors can get better?
Absolutely. I've seen it firsthand. And those families were brave enough to come to us and ask for help. And I can't say enough about how important, if you're getting ABA services, that your role is as a parent in, because you're part of the treatment team, in helping to reduce the challenging behaviors. And we can't do it without parents' help or caregivers' help.
Yeah.
Them to be involved every step of the way. We want them to be involved every step of the way. Almost every single ABA treatment facility has parent training. Insurance has authorized parent training codes so that you can be part of that experience from the beginning. And so you know what to do. And so you have the tools in your toolbox to be prepared to deal with all of these behaviors that can be really, you know, they can invoke emotions that can be difficult. You know, it's not easy, especially it's not easy for clinicians sometimes. And it's especially not easy for parents.
Yeah.
These are the children that they love. And, yeah, I guess that's just my takeaway is we need your support if you're seeking ABA treatment that,
absolutely. I feel like a lot of times with these kiddos, the parents are fried. They're just absolutely fried. And you guys are wanting respite. That's what you want. And that while ABA can momentarily be a respite for you so that you get a breather, it's not respite. It really, because the fact of the matter is that then the session is over and it's you who goes home with your kiddo. And you need to be able to handle whatever is happening. So I want to encourage families, get respite too, but that's not really what your ABA is. it might be that occasionally your ABA is an opportunity for you to have respite, but that's not what ABA is intended for. We really want you learning it, and you do need respite. So ask for respite. Because it's important. The first thing that I asked for at CARD was they made me make a list of what I wanted. And I said, I want him, to go to sleep before 3:30 in the morning. I want him to be able to talk again because he was talking and then we lost language. And I want him to stop hitting his head on the kitchen floor. And they said, okay, the first thing we're going to work on is the sleep thing. And I said, I really think you need to work on the banging the head on the kitchen floor thing because he's going to do damage. Well, they had me set up the house in a different way so that he couldn't hurt himself. But they said, you have to work on the sleep thing first, because if you don't get rest, you're not going to be able to do the intervention we have in mind for that. And I always think about that. We have to make sure that we get some rest. So you do need respite, but you also need to learn these techniques so that you can do it. So that's an amazing thing. Jen, you are just amazing. And we are so lucky to have you. And thank you so much for taking this time to explain this topic for us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. And one last thing that you said is so important is that we always ask families, because we're so involved with them, to rule out anything like any sleep issues, any medical issues that child or adult may be experiencing. So once that's rolled out, then we sort of take the next steps with the behavioral interventions. But that is something that's really important. That could be another piece of the puzzle that we're dealing with when we look at severe behaviors.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you brought that up. And I want to say too, you know, one of the things that I've always loved about CARD, and I love with Dr. Grampy Shea back at CARD, because she is such a proponent of this, of looking at the whole individual and ruling out medical issues and looking at dietary, you know, what I'm allergic to wheat. And if you feed me wheat, I guarantee you, I will engage in challenging behavior. I am not a happy soul when I have wheat and I have no, I'm an adult who's verbal and I have no control of it. I am crabby in the, my blood pressure goes up, my temperature goes up, my skin feels itchy, and I am like unhappy. So if that's what it's like for me, imagine what it's like for a child who, you know, they don't know that they're allergic to wheat, and it could be anything that they're allergic to. I'm just saying that these things can play a role, and I love that Dr. Grampy Shea was always at the forefront of this, and that we have wonderful clinicians like you that are mindful of that and saying, let's look at that with this behavior. I'm so thrilled about that. Thank you so much for bringing that up. That would have been so remiss if we did not talk about that. Fantastic. Thank you again. And we look forward to seeing you again soon. Hug your kiddos for us.
Love you. Thank you, Shannon.
Take care. Bye-bye. What a wonderful, wonderful young woman. Isn't she just a joy and a treat, and talking about such a difficult topic. But I hope the walk away for you guys is that there is hope, that there is help, but you're going to have to seek it out. You're going to have to be honest. You're going to have to be willing to talk about it. You're going to have to be willing to listen to the experts and try some things a little bit different, but amazing things can happen. There's always hope. So we hope that you will do that. I got to talk just for a minute about some of the things that we have coming up next week. Oh my goodness. We were just talking about, you know, could there be other things? Could it be biomedical? Well, guess who's here on Monday? Lisa Ackerman, the founder of TACA, which is the Autism Community in Action. She's going to be here with us. She's going to talk about some of the conferences that they have going on right now, right this minute, but some of the things coming up, as well as some of the more recent trends and things that parents should be aware of and resources that you should be aware of. Then on Tuesday, Dr. Graham Pichet is going to be with us, and we are going to be talking about, if I have my we're going to be talking about food selectivity. So if your kiddo is, you know, they'll eat this, but they won't eat that, we're going to talk about that and answer questions about that. On Wednesday, Marcy Fibro is going to be here. She's a wonderful autism expert, and she's going to talk particularly about autism at school and supports you might want and need, and about what's the test, the assessment that you can ask for if you think that your child could benefit from a one-to-one aid, and what that process might look like. So all of that and much more. Then on Thursday, Jennifer Yakos. We have so many wonderful Jennifers this month. Jennifer Yakos will be here, and I've asked her to come because she's so brilliant at so many different things. But I've asked her to come and talk with us about what resources are available for us if we want to learn more about autism. Maybe we want the person at school who's dealing with our child to learn more about autism. We want our babysitter to learn more about autism. We want to learn more about autism. She's got some great tips for us. And then on Friday, oh my gosh, on Friday, we are going to be joined by Christine and Abby Romeo. You know Abby because she is one of the current stars of Love on the Spectrum USA. Abby and David, we all fell in love with Abby and David on the show. They became a couple on the show. And if you haven't seen season 2, make sure you watch it before Friday. She's going to be here with her amazing mom, who's also on the show. We're going to talk about what their lives are like now, what it's like being celebrities. I have to tell you, Abby has a line of hats that she makes herself, and they are the cutest, fabulous, hippest thing you've ever seen. You can find those hats by Abby. Go find her on Instagram. Amazing. We'll talk about mermaids. We'll talk about lions. We'll talk about all of it. It's the first time that we've had them on the show. We've featured Abby before on the show on one of our Stories of the Spectrum. She is also a singer, and there's a wonderful, wonderful song that she did and performed called The Girl in the Mirror. That is also Abby. So we've had her on the show before, but not live and just her performing in her music video. So it'll be really fun. And her mom, Christine, through a very weird set of circumstances, we know each other from way back. And partially her mom is why I do red carpets now. I know it's the weirdest thing, and I didn't know that until recently. I didn't know that's who she was, but yeah, we'll disclose all of that next week. You'll be like, what? I can't even believe this. So more on that next week. That's what's happening. And then we have one part of a week where we're going to close out this amazing month. Don't forget, if you've missed any of the previous episodes, they're all available right now on podcast and on YouTube. Check it all out. We'll be back on Monday. Until then, give your kiddos a hug from me and one for you too. Bye-bye for now.